Hello, everybody. Welcome to a new episode of The Dissenter. I'm your host, Ricardo Lopes, and today I'm joined by Dr. Cecilia Hayes. She is a professor of psychology and senior research fellow in theoretical life science at All Souls College, University of Oxford. She was trained as an experimental psychologist at University College London. As a Harkness Fellow in the United States, she studied evolutionary epistemology with Donald T. Campbell and philosophy of mind with Daniel Dennett. She's done experimental work, initially in animal cognition and later in cognitive neuroscience. And more recently, her group developed and tested an associative account of the origins of imitation and the mirror neuron system. She's also the author of the book which we're going to focus the most on today, which is called Cognitive Gadgets, The Cultural Evolution of Thinking. So, Dr. Hayes, thank you a lot for taking the time to come on the show. It's a real pleasure to have you on.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Okay, great. So, I mean, I've been having a lot of evolutionary psychologists on the show, and I've also had Drs. Robert Boyd and Peter Richardson, and it's very interesting to everyone because in your book you talk about a lot about high church evolutionary psychology, and you refer to the work of Lida Cosmides, John Tooby, Steven Pinker, and others, and also what we could call cultural evolutionary theory. I guess that you focus mostly on the California School of Cultural Evolution, right? Headed by Drs. Boyd, Richardson, Henrich, and others. So I guess that the first question would be, when you look at evolutionary psychology and cultural evolutionary theory, what parts of the knowledge that comes from there you adopt in your work? And what are the assumptions that people make in those disciplines that you tend to reject?
Okay, first of all, high church or classic evolutionary psychology. I'm a great admirer of the founding work in that field. In particular, the way that Lida Cosmides and John Tooby brought together, I think for the first time, evolutionary analysis with the computational way of thinking about the mind, thinking about the mind as like a computer, as like the software running on the brain. So prior to that, there had been sociobiology and other kinds of behavioral biology that had, you know, sort of interested themselves in psychology, but the only psychology they used was sort of everyday folk psychology. And Cosmides and Tooby said for the first time, look, there's a better kind of psychology out there, which has been developed through empirical research. That's what we need to splice together with evolutionary analysis in order to understand the evolution of the human mind. I think that was a key insight. I think it's kind of the computationalism, the way of viewing the mind as like software, has kind of drained out of evolutionary psychology to some degree. A lot of focus on mating preferences, sexual behavior in general, but behavior rather than the software which is controlling the behavior. But nonetheless, I've taken from high church evolutionary psychology the mind construed as software as the explanatory target for evolutionary analysis. That's what we need to explain. Where I disagree with them about it is the idea that you can do this just with reference to genes. So I think evolutionary psychology is deeply and unashamedly nativist. It thinks that, you know, there's programs for the development of ways of thinking which we inherit in our genes. And I can understand why smart people thought that 25 years ago. If you think about the evidence they had available then, it was a pretty good bet. But I think the evidence which has come in the last 25 years suggests that, you know, natural selection operating on genes has not been the principal architect of the human mind. So one option would be give up on evolutionary analysis of the human mind. But there's another option available, which comes from cultural evolutionary theory. And yes, I am thinking of the California School, led by Rob Boyd and Pete Richardson, and now their former students, who've become distinguished contributors in their own right. And they are using evolutionary theory in the cultural domain. So the claim there is that there is a fundamental variation and selective retention algorithm, a Darwinian kind of process operating, but it's not sorting and sifting genetic variants, it's sorting and sifting cultural variants. So that's what I see as the strength of cultural evolutionary theory, which can be combined very powerfully with the computational view of the mind. For the moment, my quibble with cultural evolutionary theory is that it tends to, it does a lot of great modeling work. That modeling work tends to idealize over psychological questions, tends to not get into really how the mind's working when we're learning things from others, for example. And insofar as it gets into psychology at all, it buys the high church evolutionary psychology story that, you know, fundamentally the way that we think is programmed in the genes. So I want to take the good bits from both the mind construed as software from evolutionary psychology, the idea that you can have cultural evolution from cultural evolutionary theory.
Yes, and that's very interesting, because in my interviews with Drs. Boyd and Richardson, I really got that sense that whenever they try to explain where things come from, basically how we acquire culture, how we transmit culture to one another, they resort very easily to explanations based on some sort of genetic machinery or something that is transmitted via genes between people. Like, for example, they talk about certain biases that we have when transmitting and acquiring information. For example, model-based biases, frequency-dependent biases, content-based biases, and it seems that all of those things they are talking about are already programmed into our minds, and then they start from there, they build from them, from there up to perhaps I don't know, sometimes via game theoretical approaches, how certain traditions spread between people and turn into social norms sometimes and things like that. So basically at the core of it, cultural evolutionary theory, as it is approached by the California School of Thinking in this case, at its core, it's a form of evolutionary psychology, really.
I think that's right. I do. As you say, all of those learning biases, they assume that we genetically inherit the propensity to show those biases, and perhaps that we genetically inherit the potential to engage in certain high fidelity social learning at all, methods of acquiring information through observation and interaction with others, as well as the biases on those processes. So in a way, I want to encourage cultural evolutionary psychologists to be more thoroughgoing, in a sense, to be more ambitious, to say, you know, you can apply the kind of cultural evolutionary analysis that you're using, not just to change over time in beliefs and technology and practices. It can be applied to the mental machinery which enables us to learn from others' beliefs and ideas and practices and technology.
Mm-hmm. So that's the distinction in your book that you make between greased and mills. That is, perhaps the cultural evolutionary theorists are more focused on trying to explain beliefs and skills instead of coming up with cultural explanations for the evolution of certain cognitive mechanisms, that it might be the case that they are the results of cultural processes.
Exactly. So it seems to me that they assume that the mills of the mind, the cognitive processes, the ways of thinking, are genetically inherited, and they're just looking at how the operation of those mills can allow grist, beliefs, practices, technology to change sometimes in an adaptive way across cultural generations. So that's the grist mills distinction. It's not a perfect metaphor. I mean, I got the metaphor from Thomas Aquinas in the 13th century. He had this metaphor of the mind as consisting of, you know, mills, which is somehow the operations. Grist is what you think, as opposed to how you think. I think it's a not bad first approximation for just to point out the extension of cultural evolutionary theory that I think is possible and promising.
Mm-hmm. So let's get a little bit more into the nitty-gritty here, because another very big topic that you explore in your book has to do with modularity of mind, because I guess that evolutionary psychologists assume they have a vision of massive modularity of mind in terms of the mind being composed by several specialized mechanisms that deal with specific kinds of evolutionarily relevant information and that give us outputs, particularly in terms of behavior, to try to solve those same problems that are presented to us, evolutionarily speaking. And they don't like that much to talk about domain general modules. They assume that the mind is simply different, a lot of different specific modules that are, as they call them, domain specific. And in your book, I guess that many of the ways you try to explain how things like, and we're going to talk about that later, imitation and mind reading arise in our minds are mostly the product of domain general mechanisms. So what would you like to say about that? I mean, the vision that evolutionary psychologists have, and perhaps the relationship between domain-specific and domain-general modules.
Okay, I think I certainly do emphasize domain-general mental processes much more than the high church evolutionary psychologists. But like them, I am suggesting that what makes humans, human minds, different from those of other animals is that we have a set of domain-specific cognitive processes. But whereas they would say, well, those domain-specific cognitive processes have been produced by natural selection operating on genes, I say those domain-specific cognitive processes are produced in the course of childhood through social interaction, and they get better at doing their jobs. They get more adaptive over generations through cultural evolution. So I'm casting the domain general processes as partly the cranes and other kinds of heavy machinery that does the construction process. So in order to build a whole new way of thinking, for example, a whole new way of thinking about other agents, to think about other agents as individuals that have thoughts and feelings, beliefs and desires. In order to build the capacity to do that, we need lots of interaction with other people to get ideas from them and to get ways of thinking about others. But we also need kind of machinery on board to construct a new way of thinking. And I see that machinery that does the construction within childhood as being domain general machinery. It's capable, like cranes and concrete mixers, those are capable of building a variety of different sorts of buildings. exactly what kind of building they construct depends on architects. And within this metaphor, it depends on the social environment that you live in as to what kind of new way of thinking is constructed using this general purpose machinery.
So in terms of modularity of mind, is it the case that you also criticize the approach by evolutionary psychologists? Because it seems that at least until now, that it's not been really possible for us to pin down precise locations in the brain or neural pathways that correspond to each of the specific modules that evolutionary psychologists have been identifying.
I don't see the lack of discrete neural centers as a particular problem. I think a claim about modularity, or in my mind, an interesting modularity claim, is about the kinds of computations which are used. It's kind of a claim about the software, how the software operates. And you can get clues about how software operates by looking at the brain. But, and I think there was early on an idea, and Jerry Fodor may have done something to promote this idea, that somehow in order for there to be a module in good standing, there needed to be a part of the brain that did it. But it was never entirely clear why neural localization, anatomical localization, had to go along with computational distinctiveness, it being a special way of thinking. So I don't see the brain data as having been especially a problem for classical evolutionary psychology. I see it more as just the evidence suggests what I call wealth of the stimulus, that there's a huge amount of variation across cultures, across points in development, across children who grow up in different socioeconomic conditions within a culture and so on. There's a huge amount of variation in how they think. And that variation correlates with the social environment in which they're growing up. So that makes a prima facie case for the differences are due to the social environment, rather than the potential to develop these ways of thinking being genetically inherited.
So, you know, I've also asked you about that because I've interviewed Dr. Cosmides, and she told me about how she was very frustrated that Jerry Fodor put forth that idea about encapsulated modules in this case. And then later I talked with Dr. Patricia Churchland, and she made that very criticism that it was, in her understanding, modularity of mind didn't hold any water at all because we weren't able to pin down precise locations in the brain for each specific module. But Dr. Cosmides, in my interview with her, said the same thing that you just told us, that basically we don't need that. We would just need to have perhaps different parts of the brain integrated into producing a specific cognitive or mental mechanism.
Yeah, I'm very much on Leda's side in this, although I find Pat Churchland's eliminativism about mental, as it were, you know, the sort of the prediction that it's only a matter of time before scientists stop talking about the mind altogether. You know, it's all down to the brain. And even the prediction that that'll be true of us all in everyday life, we'll stop talking about beliefs and desires and thoughts and feelings and all of those kinds of things. I find it exhilarating to read about. I find it completely implausible. I think that there's genuine value in having, even if you're a good materialist who doesn't think there's any spooky stuff, as Pat calls it, you know, any sort of dualism, she'll say that's a belief in spooky stuff. I agree with her, that dualism's a belief in spooky stuff. But you don't have to believe in spooky stuff to think that there's value in having a level of abstraction at which you characterize the way the brain operates, which acts as a bridge between our everyday life understanding of ourselves and other people and our understanding of how the brain operates from neuroscience. So I think that intermediate level of description is really important, and that neuroscience can inform that, but that it shouldn't be enslaved by it. Just because there isn't a bit of the brain that does it doesn't mean it isn't a real entity and a useful entity in science.
You know, that's very interesting, because I've also had Dr. Alexander Rosenberg on the show, and he's a very extreme, what you could call perhaps eliminativist reductionist, in the sense that he doesn't believe in beliefs, and he says that people don't even think in the way that we think about thinking, let's say. It's a bit complicated, but anyway, whenever I think about that, I think that perhaps if we followed down that route, then we would eventually be led back to Skinnerian behaviorism or something like that, because if what happens in the mind doesn't matter, I mean, of course, those people are taking into account what happens inside the brain, and Skinner perhaps also didn't care about that, but anyway, we would be left with that, right?
Yes, and I certainly wouldn't welcome that, although many people, I mean, because you asked about domain general cognitive processes, and I happen to believe that associative learning is one of the really valuable domain general cognitive resources. And that makes some people think that I'm a Skinnerian, which doesn't follow at all. So I also wouldn't welcome that kind of transformation back to just neuroscience and a Skinnerian approach. I think would be a real step back. But, you know, Alex Rosenberg, Pat Churchland, they're philosophers. That's what we want from philosophers, to think the unthinkable to some degree. It doesn't mean that we need to agree with them, but it's always, I think, valuable to reflect on these things. And their work, I think, has helped to put folk psychology in context, to make so that psychologists like Leda Cosmides and me, and I think most cognitive scientists, think there is value in having an intermediate level of explanation between brain talk and folk psychology. It's not that we want the whole of scientific psychology to be about beliefs and desires. And I think the work of eliminativist philosophers has made clear why it's not a good idea to try and center the whole of scientific psychology on beliefs and desires, that we need another more subtle intermediate level of explanation. Mm-hmm. Kind of the computer software style. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right. So before we get into specific examples like the one of imitation and mind reading, or theory of mind as it's also known, I would like to ask you, to what extent do you think that cultural influences or social influences that might be on the basis of the development of these cognitive mechanisms are deterministic? And I would like to ask you about that, because I remember that I talked with Dr. Robert McCauley, that is one of the founders of the field of the cognitive science of religion, and at a certain point we were referring to certain experiments that people did with people from other cultures, where, for example, they have a set of names for different colors, or they orient themselves in space differently than we do in Western society. Instead of using left and right and front and back, they use, for example, the cardinal points, you know. And at a certain point, I refer to the fact that in many of those situations, it seems to me that if we retrain people to use other sorts of spatial orientation, or if we provide them with more words to describe colors or to identify colors, then they are able to pick up on that very quickly, it seems to me. So do you think that That's a good way of thinking about things, that perhaps if people are exposed to different cultural cognitive frameworks, they are able to pick up on them fairly easily, or that they go through development, and because they have been exposed to a certain culture, that it in some way is deterministic, and it's hard for them to acquire new cognitive tools.
I think certainly a core prediction of my cognitive gadgets approach is that our minds are agile, they're flexible, they're highly plastic. And that's not to say it's without limit. So if you learn something in infancy and it's a fundamental feature of, for example, the way in which you engage with other people, then there, it's likely to be, you know, a bit tricky to shift by later learning. It's got deeply what Bill Wimsatt calls generatively entrenched. You've built a whole bunch of other things on top of it. So if you now try and pull this brick out from underneath, you create chaos in things that developed subsequently and were built on top of it. So I think there can be that kind of phenomenon which can make people resistant to relearning. But yes, compared with high church or standard evolutionary psychology, cultural evolutionary psychology suggests no, not deterministic. You know, we retain flexibility into adult life.
And that's interesting because that also clashes with the idea of critical periods of acquiring certain cognitive traits or mechanisms, right?
Yes, I think it does. I mean, it doesn't necessarily conflict with critical periods for the development of all psychological attributes. It conflicts with the idea of critical periods for the development of distinctively human cognitive mechanisms. So the mechanisms which are, you know, present in adult humans and either absent in other animals, or where there's only a trace of them in other animals. So, you know, those distinctively human cognitive mechanisms, as I call it, yeah, one wouldn't expect critical periods for their development. Certainly not critical periods as classically construed, like the genes open a window for some experience to be had. If you get the experience during that period, then there'll be normal development of the attribute. If you don't, then, you know, kind of your development is screwed up forever. That could in principle happen for other domain general cognitive processes that we share with other animals. You know, my view doesn't really say anything about that, but it says no critical periods for distinctively human cognitive processes.
Okay, so now let's get into a couple of examples. Let's start with imitation, because perhaps talking about specific examples, it's easier for people to understand what we're talking about here. So starting with imitation, so it seems that the reason why people for a long time believed and still believe that imitation is an innate cognitive trait that humans have, particularly over-imitation, right? Because it seems that there are other species that also are able to imitate their conspecifics, at least to a certain extent, but that it was mostly based on the work by Andrew Meltzoff, and in a very few number of studies, I think that they involved mainly tongue protrusion and things like that. So could you tell us where that came from, and perhaps what are the main reasons why it might be wrong?
Okay, so I think until the late 1970s, there was pretty much a consensus that the development of imitation, meaning specifically the capacity to copy the way in which parts of the body move relative to one another. So, you know, if I raise an eyebrow, then that's a movement of my eyebrow relative to the rest of my face, relative to my eyes or whatever. You know, if I close my fingers into a fist, that's a movement relative, you know, of the fingers relative to each other into the palm. This has always been a slightly mysterious capacity in humans. Not so much hand movements, because we can see ourselves perform hand movements, but things like facial expressions and whole body movements. How do I know when I'm doing the same thing as I saw you do? Because after all, when I raise my eyebrow, I just get a bit more light into that eye. When I see you raise an eyebrow, I see this little arc move on a disc. Those two things don't have anything in common visually. So how would I even know if I was being successful in copying you? So always a bit of a mystery as to how we could do that, thought to be very important in human evolution and human development. Up until the late 1970s, people thought, well, this is something that we learn to do predominantly. We learn it through social interaction. Jean Piaget was more or less saying that there might have been some inborn preparation to learn, but a lot of the work was done in the course of development through social interaction. Then a young Andy Meltzoff makes this striking discovery, takes a whole bunch of newborn babies and uses a really clever method to test whether they can copy facial expression, and seems to find evidence that these newborns can copy a whole range of facial expressions. They can copy an adult sticking out their tongue, an adult opening their mouth, an adult protruding their lips. And he argues, well, so there must be an instinct to imitate. These newborns, they haven't had a chance to learn how to do it through interaction with other people. It can't just be a reflex, because it's not just one action they can copy, it's a whole range. And this really revolutionized people's understandings of imitation. And there was a fair amount of thinking, well, you know, if there's an instinct for imitation, there might be instincts for all kinds of other things. So in a way, this also paved the way for evolutionary psychology, which sort of came online 10 years later, 15 years later. But right from the very beginning, there were people who tried to replicate these results and had difficulty. Andy Meltzoff's own lab replicated it repeatedly. There were other labs that managed to replicate it. So this was all a bit unsatisfactory. Was it replicable or was it not? Some people suggested it's all kind of an artifact connected with tongue protrusion, that when you stick your tongue out at a baby, it makes the baby excited. And what babies happen to do when they're excited is stick their tongues out. And so it wasn't exactly that the babies were looking at the tongue protrusion and specifically matching that action. It just happened that an excited response looked like the stimulus in this particular case. But so years of uncertainty, and then a couple of years ago, a group in Brisbane did a fantastic study. They tested 100 babies. This is a sample of unprecedented size. They tested for every action that's ever been tested in newborns, and they used this great method introduced by Andy Meltzoff, and they found no evidence for imitation of anything but tongue protrusion. They weren't even sure they got evidence of imitation of tongue protrusion. So I think most people without a dog in the fight believe that this settles a question which has been rumbling for decades, and it settles it in the negative, that we should go back to where we were in 1977 when we assumed that the capacity to imitate was essentially a developmental achievement, something which was learned.
Mm-hmm. Right. And other things that you talk about in your book are also the fact that imitation can be enhanced, abolished, or reversed by novel experiences, in this case sensory motor experiences. And you also refer to certain cases of counter-imitation training. So, I mean, it can also happen that, for example, if we are trained to imitate a robot, let's say, that people can also learn to do that. And If we are put in a situation where we are instructed to perform one kind of action and the other person is doing another sort of action, then that's where we get counter-imitation training, because what we were trying to imitate in that person sort of gets abolished, in a sense, because we are performing a different sort of action.
Exactly. I think the little story I told you about, you know, the fate of neonatal imitation, there's a broad consensus that that puts us back to the point where we should assume that the capacity to imitate is learned. My group has a very specific theory of how we learn to imitate, and we've done lots of experiments testing the predictions of that theory. And essentially the predictions of that theory is that it will be possible just as readily to copy a robot as to copy a human. We should be just as able to counter imitate, to systematically do the opposite as to copy, under the right learning conditions. So essentially we put adults into circumstances where they relearn, and after the relearning, they are fluently counter-copying, or they are fluently copying robots. So it very much relates to what you were asking about determinism and flexibility in adulthood. We're showing that even adults can relearn their proclivity to imitate.
Mm-hmm. So there are really certain kinds of behaviorist mechanisms operating here, perhaps not Skinnerian behaviorist, but other kinds of associative learning and sequence learning and things like that.
Yes, certainly associative learning, the formation of excitatory and inhibitory links between visual and motor or tactile representations of action. I mean, just a little bit of history connected to the Skinnerian issue. I mean, my reading of the history here is that the idea of associative learning was developed by the British empiricists, Locke and Hume and so on, more than 300 years ago, and had been developed by philosophers, and then began to be developed by experimental psychologists once experimental psychology came online at the end of the 19th century. Then there was this brief period of behaviorism when it was like associationism was taken over by the behaviorists. Behaviorism died, associationism went on developing, getting more and more refined, the theory of associative learning, but somehow people associate associative learning with this brief behaviorist period in its history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So, but I would like to ask you now, because this came to my mind while we were talking about imitation and other things, there are different people that come up with different approaches to try to determine that some sort of human behavior is innate. And they have several different criteria. For example, if it has a phylogenetic basis, that is, if we find it in other species, particularly the ones that are closely related to ours, that's the phylogenetic way. Then they also refer to, for example, if the behavior arises in early stages of development, particularly in children, right, and before they have been able to, they were exposed to social learning in certain way, in any way, or socialization, and then they also refer, of course, to cross-cultural validation, that is, if they find human universals, that's another criteria. And then if there's, for example, an endocrinological or neurological basis to it, I mean, there are different criteria that people use. But in this case of imitation, and we're going to also talk about mind reading next, Do you think that in any way they could fulfill those sort of criteria and still be innate or not?
Well, I'm not sure. Let's take the imitation example. Research from Mike Tomasello's Max Planck Institute suggests that chimpanzees, on the whole, don't imitate. If you're working on the principle of if you find something in chimpanzees, then it can't be, it must be innate in humans. Funny kind of logic, just stated like that. But even if you take it that way, then it doesn't look like imitation is innate. The story that I just told you about, neonatal imitation, and we thought we got evidence of it, and then it looks like we don't. So it looks like imitation doesn't meet that criterion. But I think these criteria, you're right that there's these kind of conventional things that people point to and say there, that means it's innate. But they often don't ask why. Why are those things taken as markers? And I think Chomsky was really good on this. There's a general principle that embraces all of these things, which he called poverty of the stimulus. If something is present in chimpanzees, but they don't have the input in the course of development that humans have, then that would imply that even in humans this is innate. Because the chimps have got it too. It can't be the experience the humans are having because the chimps have got it and they haven't got that experience. That would be a poverty of the stimulus argument. Similarly, if something develops so early in childhood that there's no way the child could have had appropriate experience to build it, then it must be innate. But when one reflects on the reason why these criteria are there, that it's to do with poverty versus wealth of the stimulus, then it leads one to look more closely at the evidence. So, for example, you find developmental psychologists often saying, well, I'm finding a bias towards conformity in 18-month-old infants or in 2-year-olds or something like that. Just because they are 18 months, it must mean that, this is innate. No, by 18 months, infants have had a lot of experience. You've got to know what experience they've had and whether it's the kind of experience which could direct them towards conformity, that could make them conformist. So I think one can't use a tick box approach as such. One needs to ask, was there enough information in the animal's or the human child's environment? Enough information in that environment that could have supported the development of this without a specific genetic predisposition.
Yes, that part about the early acquisition of a particular behavior or cognitive trait during development is very interesting because when we talk about socialization, we tend to think in terms of transmitting information verbally via language, for example. And that might not be the case. I mean, we might not need to transmit information in that way to be influencing children already, right?
Absolutely. So, I mean, for example, with the development of imitation, it looks as if it's largely non-verbal interactions which enable children to become capable of imitating. It's things like being imitated by adults. So when an adult copies the facial movement of the child, that gives the child the opportunity to form an association between the feel of doing this with their face and the sight of seeing an adult do it. So they forge that sensory motor association so that next time they see this facial expression, it gives them an urge, as it were, to perform the matching action. So that's an example of where it's a non-verbal interaction that occurs between an adult and an infant. that builds the potential for imitation in the infant.
Very interesting. So let's now move on to talk about mind reading, because I guess that this is even more difficult to convince people that really mind reading or theory of mind is not innate, because we look around and even in different cultures, and it seems pretty obvious to us that everyone has at least some sort of mind reading. They are able to read other people's minds and to think about their own thinking and what might be around, what might be going around in other people's minds. So how can you convince people that mind reading might not be innate?
Well, I think I would first go for that assumption that we all tend to make, that the world over, people understand one another in terms of their thoughts and feelings. And, you know, I'm no ethnographer, but I think there's quite a bit of evidence that there is very marked cultural variation. A study which sticks in my mind was done by Howell with, I think, a group in Brazil. And what he wanted, he spent 2 years with these people who'd had minimal contact with sort of the American European culture. And all he wanted to do was to document all the vocabulary that they had for mental states. And he found just five terms, which he translated as want very much, no, forget, and remember. So, I mean, that contrasts with hundreds of terms for mental states in, say, English and in most European languages. So that's a pretty marked contrast. Also, the metaphysical assumptions associated with mind reading, marked variation. You know, where are mental states? Apparently, I mean, this is a coming from a review article by Lillard in, I think, 1998. People who believe that mental states kind of hover outside the head, and certainly a wide sweep of cultures who use an individual's social status within the group and the circumstances in which that individual finds themselves now, they use those two factors to predict what that individual is going to do, much more than they use speculation about what that individual wants and thinks and so on. So I think there might be a lot more variation than we imagine that there is. And also, I think on the positive side, there's lots of excellent work looking at child development, looking at the way that the rate at which understanding of the mind in terms of beliefs and desires develops in children can be predicted by how much conversation about the mind there is between those children and their parents. So that's, you know, again, evidence of wealth of the stimulus, that the rate of development is varying with the richness of the information available in the child's social environment.
And here we get again into the issue of the poverty versus the wealth of the stimulus, because this is a very important point to make here, that it is the case that adults teach children, at least to a certain extent, about how to think about the minds of other people and their own as well.
Yes, and I think in that case it's a combination of teaching, in a way, both grist and mills. So through, you know, say a parent is looking at a picture book with a child and they might point at a picture and say, oh look, the little boy's smiling. He's smiling because he's happy. He's happy because he's playing with the dog. Now in a way that's specifying a number of rule-like relationships between behavior and mental states, between activities and mental states and behavior and so on. You could see that as the grist of mind reading. What are these relationships between activities and mental states and relationships between mental states. But also there's research suggesting that our whole capacity to conceive of mental states may be provided by learning to use certain grammatical structures in language. So I think in the case of mind reading, the development of the capacity to read minds may be highly dependent on language, both the learning of grammar and also the communication through language of the fundamentals of a particular culture's theory of mind.
Yes, that's very interesting, because one thing that immediately came to my mind was the fact that there are a lot of linguists that really don't believe that much in the idea that language influences the way we look at the world and the way we think. Steven Pinker, for example, talks a lot about mentalism and basically that we can have thoughts without having language, and so, for example, we can have some thoughts that it is really hard for us to put to or to translate into language. So that's a very complicated relationship there, right, between language and thinking, and the extent to which the language we use might influence the way we think, and it's not obvious, right?
Far from obvious. As you say, very complex set of issues, and I'm not an expert on that. But I can say that when I first sort of started down this path of developing a cultural evolutionary account of the distinctive features of the human mind, I was expecting that the story about language being genetically inherited, or the propensity to develop language being genetically inherited, I assumed that that would be absolutely sound, and therefore that I would be building my cultural evolutionary story on a foundation in which, you know, perhaps the one thing which is genetically inherited in humans is the propensity, you know, is grammatical information, so the propensity to develop language with certain characteristics. So I was shocked when I went to that literature and found out the advances that the cultural evolutionists about language have made, the achievements of their computational models, so computational models which don't have any language-specific information built into them. They're just left to run on linguistic input, and they develop sophisticated capacities to understand grammar through experience of exposure to artificial grammars. Research suggesting that, you know, children who were once thought to have very specific language impairments, you know, that the one problem that these children had was in learning language, recent research showing that instead, no, all of the children with what was thought to be these specific problems have more general problems in learning sequences. So it seems now, even though I'm not an expert looking over the fence, it seems that even the evidence for genetic inheritance of a propensity to learn language is not secure.
So going back for a moment to mind reading, because there's a very interesting aspect there that I think is worth exploring a little bit more. So children are taught, at least to a certain extent, on how to think about other people's minds and what goes around in their minds, and even the association between what happens in their minds and their overt behavior, what they see happening in a way. So I was thinking how that might influence, for example, how we think about emotions, and even perhaps how we feel, because it's very easy to imagine then that if we are taught to associate a particular word with a particular emotion or feeling, then that might influence both how we think about what's happening in the other person's mind when she says, for example, I'm feeling happy, I'm feeling sad, I'm feeling angry, and also perhaps the way we ourselves feel, because we also associate feelings with specific events and specific actions, and so through associative learning, perhaps, I mean, that could also construct the how we experience things and even ultimately our sense of self, maybe.
I find that very plausible. I'm not an expert on emotion, but I'm interested in the work of Feldman Barrett, who I think very much takes, Lisa Feldman Barrett, very much takes that view of emotion, that there is, this may be my version of what she says, which may not be exactly what she says. Certainly I find it plausible that there are a lot of interceptive signals which, you know, they in a sense, they are not culturally constructed. Our body is making certain physiological responses to events occurring in the outside world, but our emotion language chops up that sea of experience into chunks and offers an interpretation of what those chunks signify about the world, about ourselves, and so on. And that categorization or chunking process is highly subject to cultural influence via language. So that's absolutely fits with the idea that our emotional experience is deeply affected by the culture in which we grow up. The self, gosh, yes, that's a complicated, culturally conditioned construct, isn't it? Yeah. So yes, I would have thought that was very definitely a target. Whether it's a target for, I mean, like any other component of mind reading, a target for cultural evolution.
Mm-hmm. And that's very interesting, because if your approach, the cultural, evolutionary, psychological, or the cognitive gadgets approach to these sorts of mechanisms is true, then I would imagine very easily that if different people teach children differently on how to think about minds, then that would be a big reason as to why there's so much misunderstanding between people, because it's really, it would be very easy for people to learn how to think about minds in a certain way and for other people to learn that in another way, and for those two different or three different or whatever number of ways there is to think about minds to conflict with one another.
Yes, I think that's a potential source of confusion, miscommunication. Going back to Pat Churchland, I mean, another possibility is that even when communicators share a theory of mind or a way of mind reading, that's a very imprecise view of the way that the mind works, that belief, desire, talk of thoughts and feelings captures something about the way that minds work, but only in a very approximate sense, that this is not an exact science. And so even if all members of a community have been taught the same thing, they all agree on the same principles, they may still have an awful lot of trouble working out, in a particular case, what does this person think or feel? So I think lots of sources of noise there.
Mm-hmm. So do you think that the way we think about minds and emotions and all those sorts of mental phenomena might be negatively influencing research on those same phenomena? Because I was just thinking, for example, about the work of Paul Ekman when he investigated or researched cross-cultural human universals in facial expressions, And I mean, it was not simply describing the facial expressions. There was a word or an emotion that went along with them. And I mean, couldn't it be the case that whenever people try to do that, perhaps they are somewhat misleading themselves because they are under the influence of their own cultural framework?
Yes, I think that that's absolutely a risk. And the only thing I would say is it looks to me as if that kind of problem is increasingly being taken seriously. And I think Joe Henrich, who you mentioned earlier, a descendant, as it were, or a component of the California School of Cultural Evolutionary Theory, he and his collaborators, having coined this acronym WEIRD, pointing out that most psychological studies have been done on wealthy, educated, can't remember what the I stands for.
It's Western, educated, industrialized, rich and
democratic.
Democratic, yes, democratic, sorry.
Thank you very much, that's right. So, and I think, you know, the existence of that acronym has certainly heightened awareness that too much research was being done on Western samples only, weird samples only, or exactly the same procedures from Western samples were being taken to another part of the world, and some flat-footed assumptions were being made about how you could test people with very different cultural backgrounds. And I think that's really beginning to change. People are getting much more sensitive about this. People like Christine Lagarde and Mark Nielsen, among others, are now doing much more sensitive developmental work with other cultures as remote as possible from weird people like us.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, even in cultural evolutionary theory, I guess that even researchers there try to make the case, even though perhaps because they are under a lot of influence by evolutionary psychology, when they talk, for example, about gene culture coevolution, it really seems that they're trying to make the case that at least when culture creates an environmental framework that starts exerting selective pressures on genes, that perhaps that's a way by which culture could influence our genetic evolution. Of course, this would have an effect at the genetic level. It's not exactly the same thing as we being exposed to a certain culture and then via a developmental process acquiring new mental mechanisms. They would be innate as other sorts of mental mechanisms from evolutionary psychology are innate. But anyway, it seems to me that through gene culture coevolution, at least, they are trying to pay more attention to the cultural side of things.
Yes, that for sure. But I think cultural evolutionary theory, since its inception in the early 1980s, has been, I think, too swift to assume that enduring change is brought about only via the genes, as it were. I mean, that is plausible for some cases, things like lactose tolerance. So people start dairying, free supply of milk and cheese and all of those kinds of things puts selection pressure in favor of individuals who maintain, lactose tolerance, renin or whatever, which enables them to metabolize milk right up into adulthood. Makes perfect sense, that instance of gene culture coevolution. But when our cultural environment changes the way that we think and builds new cognitive mechanisms, that is likely to shield us from selection operating on the genes. In a way, we can now do something developmentally. We can adapt to novel environments using resources that we develop in the course of childhood, it might release selection pressure on the genes. So I think I would like to see more modeling work and work in evolutionary theory more generally, which acknowledges that, yes, genetic assimilation is possible, a variety of gene culture coevolution, also a kind of a screening process whereby cultural change slows down or reduces the probability of genetic change, and working out in what conditions do you get one and in what conditions do you get the other.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So what sort of implications would this all have to how we think about human nature? Because, for example, going back to evolutionary psychology, Lee the Cosmides and John Tooby developed this concept of evoked culture back in the 90s, and basically they acknowledge that there should be at least some cultural variation in certain aspects, because they assume that we all as a species have the same sort of underlying cognitive mechanisms, but because we are exposed to different ecological conditions, then people would prefer, subconsciously of course, would prefer certain strategies to others, and that would be why people in different places and different cultures exhibit different sorts of behaviors. On the basis of the same underlying cognitive mechanisms. But in this case, if we can't even be sure about the cognitive mechanisms that are universal and that are cross-cultural, then it would seem to me that human nature would be even more variable than evolutionary psychologists make of it, let's say.
Yes, I think that there's a kind of a strategic or definitional issue in here, and then there's an empirical question. So the strategic definitional issue is, you know, we can't just make up a whole new account of what we mean by human nature. The concept of human nature has a 1,000 years long history, more than 1,000 years. It's always referred to, people have identified as human nature hidden internal causes of behavior. So we want our concept of human nature to have something to do with that. So it makes sense to make it what we now understand to be cognitive mechanisms. And also, if we're going to call it human nature, we want the cognitive mechanisms we identify as human nature to be widespread. It doesn't need to be all and every human has them, and they don't need to be exactly the same in whoever has them, but they must be the ones that are shared. So I think it's possible to say human nature is consists of the types of cognitive process which are found in most people alive today. So for example, literacy would now be part of human nature, because, you know, well over 50% of humans alive today are able to read. So that would make literacy part of human nature. I think the evolutionary psychologists wanted to connect up human nature to evolution. They said, look, evolution, ever since Darwin, this was a huge intellectual achievement. We must somehow plug in our understanding of evolution to our understanding of human nature. I'm inclined to agree with them, but to identify evolution with just genetic evolution is now an anachronism. We now know that the variation and selective retention algorithm, which was the core of Darwin's striking discovery, isn't only implemented in the genetic case, there's also cultural evolution. So I think we should regard as human nature cognitive mechanisms which are present in most humans alive today, which have been shaped by evolutionary processes, and that includes biological and cultural evolution. It makes human nature labile, as the literacy examples suggest. Maybe literacy wasn't part of human nature a few decades ago. Now, thankfully, it is.
So that also makes an interesting case as to how we should think about evolutionary mismatch, as evolutionary psychologists put it, because they say that perhaps in certain circumstances, like for example, as we developed modern scientific democratic societies, and we now live in very big societies, much bigger than the Dunbar's number predicts of 150, we now live in societies of millions and millions of people, that could be a problem for us because our cognitive mechanisms wouldn't be attuned to those sorts of conditions. And if your approach is correct, then that wouldn't be that much of a problem, right?
Yes, cultural evolution can track much more rapid rates of change than genetic evolution can track. The generational turnover is, you know, if you can learn from your peers as well as from your parents, the generational turnover in cultural evolution is much more rapid, therefore more rapid environmental change, social change can be tracked. That's not to say you would never get a mismatch problem, but nonetheless, it should be much less of a problem than high church evolutionary psychology suggests. Cultural evolutionary psychology suggests, I mean, the slogan that I use, that our minds are agile but fragile. So we can adapt to relatively rapid change within our lifetimes or over just a few generations. But if there are apocalyptic events connected with climate or epidemics or something like that, standard evolutionary psychology saying we've got so much in our genes means that each new baby born is born with the propensity to develop all the distinctively human ways of thinking. Cultural evolutionary psychology says, well, that's not guaranteed. They need a certain social environment in order to develop these distinctively human ways of thinking. So if there were apocalyptic events, then we could lose not just know-how and technology and facts about the world, we could lose our capacity to imitate, to think about ourselves and others in terms of mental states, for example.
So that's funny in a way, because I was thinking about evolutionary mismatch as being a bad thing, but with that in mind, it seems like even more catastrophic, because if we were to lose these sort of cultural frameworks and cultural tools, then we could even lose cognitive mechanisms themselves.
Yes, that is an implication of cultural evolutionary psychology. We need to be very concerned about the social environments that we create for children to develop in.
Right. Okay, so perhaps just one last question. We've talked about imitation, mind reading, a little bit about language. How do you think we should approach cognitive mechanisms in general? That we should do it in a case-by-case scenario and really try to, in a case-by-case scenario, know if to what extent they are innate or acquired, and to what extent they are under the influence of culture or other environmental factors? Or do you think that cultural evolutionary psychology could develop into an all-encompassing discipline that could potentially apply to all of human cognition?
I think it would be valuable to have some encompassing modeling work done, acknowledging the possibility that it's not just the grist, it's the mills which are undergoing cultural evolutionary change. So that would be embracing. But otherwise, I see it as a framework for empirical research on a case-by-case basis. So something like what's currently known as cultural psychology produces, you know, wonderfully rich characterizations of the way in which different cultures are going about different cognitive tasks. But it's a bit atheoretical. There isn't really a sort of a framework in which it's operating. It's more of a methodology. So I think that's somewhere where cultural evolutionary psychology could be helpful. It's not that I feel that everybody should be an evolutionist. That was a feature of high church evolutionary psychology that I always found mystifying. It seemed an evangelical faith. It seemed to be saying to all psychologists, you must take an interest in the evolutionary history of the mechanisms that you study. I don't think that's necessary. I think many, many psychologists, you know, can just get on with studying the mature features of various mental processes. But those who are interested in origins, in how mental processes come to do their jobs well, in an evolutionary context, in a developmental context, and they may have focal interest in one domain or another, in morality, in causal cognition, in episodic memory, in metacognition or whatever, but this is an encompassing framework which can offer questions for empirical inquiry and can offer links with research in other cognitive domains.
Okay, very well. So, Dr. Hayes, let's end the interview here. But just before we go, would you like to tell people, apart from your book, of course, for which I will be leaving a link in the description box, what would be other good places, particularly on the internet, for them to get in touch with your work?
Well, I have a website, which lists all my publications, but also I wrote a précis of the book, which will shortly be published in the Behavioral and Brain Sciences, with about, I think, 15, 16 responses and my response to those responses. So I know that particularly laboratory scientists don't have much time to read books. It's hard work running a lab. So if they don't have time to read the book, then they could go to the précis shortly to be published in the journal, The Behavioral and Brain Sciences.
Okay, very well. So I will be leaving links to all of that in the description box of the interview. And Dr. Hayes, again, it was a real pleasure to have you on the show, and it was a very stimulating conversation. As I said, I had already had a lot of evolutionary psychologists on the show, and also the top researchers in cultural evolutionary theory. So it was really great to have a third approach on the channel. So.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it enormously.
Hi there. Thank you for coming to my channel and for watching this interview until the end. As you might have noticed, I've been putting out regular interviews with academics and intellectuals from a variety of fields. So to keep the channel sustainable, I would like to ask you to please visit my Patreon page and to consider making a pledge there. Otherwise, I also have a PayPal and Subscribestar. And if you like what I'm doing, please share it, leave a like, and hit the subscription button. I would also like to give a huge thank you to my patrons, Karen Litske, Anne Blanchett, Perelga Larsen, Lau Guerrero, Chantel Gelinas, Francis Ford, Hans Frederick Sunda, Brian Rivera, Lucas Stafiniak, Sergio Condreano, Janne Henninen, Ricardo Vladimiro, and Dr. Jerry Muller, Herbert Gintis, and Rutger Voss, and also my three producers, Isar Webb, Rosie, and Jim Frank. Thank you for all.